Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. From a Tuscan hotel for the super rich to a Brexit-paralyzed UK, Kathy spends the first summer of her 40s trying to adjust to making a lifelong commitment just as President Trump is tweeting the world into nuclear war. But it's not only Kathy who's changing. Political, social, and natural landscapes are all in peril. Fascism is on the rise, truth is dead, and the planet is heating up. Is it really worth learning to love when the end of the world is nigh? And how do you make art, let alone a life, when one rogue tweet could end it all? Crudo is the first novel from Olivia Lang, author of three critically acclaimed works of nonfiction. She charts in real time what it was like to live and love in the horrifying summer of 2017 from the perspective of a commitment-phobic artist who may or may not be Kathy Acker. We welcome Olivia Lang to The Book Show this week. Olivia, thank you very much for being with us.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
My understanding that the genesis of this novel all came very, very quickly. Give us a sense of what brought you to it.
Okay. I was in Italy in the summer of 2017, and I was failing to write a new book of nonfiction, which had proved very problematic. And I was beginning to realize it's about the body, it's about violence. And I was beginning to realize that the increasing turbulence of the times, the drastic political changes that we'd gone through, made it very hard to write the kind of reflective nonfiction that I normally write. And then it was really happenstance. I was reading Chris Krause's great biography of Kathy Acker, and I was very struck by a bit in it which talked about her stealing other people's books and changing them into the first person, so taking Great Expectations by Dickens and making it a first person book by Kathy Acker. And I thought, well, what if I take my own life and times but put it in the Kathy Acker person? What if I start recording both the transition from being a single person to getting married, which was happening for me that summer, but also what it's like to watch the world under Trump, the world under Brexit, and these drastic political shifts. And so I just started to write as Kathy, and out it all flowed.
Does that put an extra cog in the wheel in the sense of writing about you and writing about your situation probably would have been difficult slash enough of an exercise that adding this twist to it makes it all the more, maybe not difficult, but at least challenging?
I think actually it's the opposite. It made it much easier. I had this sort of imagined cartoonish consciousness, which was even more, if possible, anxious and paranoid than I was in that summer. So I could sort of dramatize what was what was going on by way of this sort of self who felt everything very strongly. And, you know, I wasn't writing it for publication. I had these sort of playful rules. I had to write it every day. I wasn't allowed to edit it. So I was really very free, freer than I have ever been as a writer, to just record everything that came my way. If Trump tweeted, into the book it went, word for word. I just took whatever I needed to try and get a feeling of this very strange moment in history.
So all along, it was you just writing in the moment. You wanted it that way from the very beginning.
I absolutely wanted it that way. I wanted to write it in real time, and I wanted to try and record. Okay, so I knew that this was a moment that will become history, that history books will be written about it. And what I thought is it will have a shape and a coherence and a narrative in 10 years' time or 20 years' time that it absolutely didn't at the moment. So what I wanted to record was what it felt like to be not knowing, to see shifts happen and to not know whether they were going to lead to something dreadful and disastrous, like potentially nuclear war, which I was extremely anxious about that summer, or whether they were going to just blow out and be absolutely nothing. So my exercise was to capture the present moment when it was still wet.
At what point do you decide that this exercise will become something that you want to publish and share with readers?
Really not until I finished it. I finished the book in Heathrow Airport, which is where the book also finishes. And I you know, closed the document, thought, okay, that was a crazy summer exercise, but, you know, I'm kind of excited about it. So I sent it to my agent, and basically by the time I'd landed from the flight, she was like, I'm sorry, but we are going to publish this, so you better deal with that.
So often in creative writing classes, we are told and taught to just have the freedom in our journals to write whatever we want, and that's what you were doing. When you look at it now, do you think, oh, well, this maybe should have been edited a little?
Actually, no. And I'm not saying that it's the sort of immaculate sentences that I normally aspire to, because it's a very different style of writing. But it's called Crudo because it's raw. And it was the rawness that I wanted to convey. And the other thing is, you know, I'm a very obsessive, meticulous writer, and I find writing agonizingly painful. So having this experience of writing with so much freedom and such sort of ability to swerve tone, to swerve topic, to shift from like the very personal about marriage, about intimacy, to the really global geopolitical, was very exciting for me as a writer. And I think it's just opened up many more avenues in what kind of hybrid between the two forms can I find next.
When it comes to writing it in just 7 weeks, we should note that you are preparing for your marriage. The character in this book is preparing for their marriage. It is very much you through this lens of Kathy.
Yeah, it's populated by my friends, it's meals that I ate, it's very much the sort of fabric of my life, but it's really the consciousness that's invented, or at least that's kind of even more sort of feverish and febrile than my own was at the time.
So when it comes to this idea of I and Kathy and how that's structured in the novel, how reliable did you want that narrator to be?
The reason I started, the first paragraph has Kathy is I, and I just wanted to put that there so that the reader had a sense that there was some sort of game going on. But after that, you can go with it in whatever way you like. You can be a Kathy Ecker expert, and you can be very interested about the way I've weaved Kathy's own writing into the book. Or you can just be following a love story about two invented characters. You don't have to know. And I know in England there's been a lot of attention in the reviews about going through my Twitter and picking out like, hey, on this day that she said she ate in this restaurant, she really did. But that kind of feels irrelevant to me. It's much more like what's interesting about it is what it feels like to be living in a present moment that has become so disturbing and frightening. I didn't feel like I needed to invent anything because I felt like reality had already got a strange enough quality thanks to our commander-in-chief.
You write about this early in the novel, that the day that President Trump fires Jim Comey, and you incorporate that within the story. And you mention that, yes, this is going to be historical. This is going to be something that we look back on and say, where were you when this happened? And yet when you continue and you read the book as we were living our lives through last summer, we also realize that, well, that was just another day, right? I mean, we're getting to a point where all of those days seem to be like that, something that is historical that you're going to think of, oh, this is a major event.
Absolutely. And the model that I had in mind when I was writing this was Christopher Isherwood's Goodbye to Berlin. So that's a book that, first of all, is, you know, this character, Christopher, who is basically Christopher Isherwood, hanging out in Berlin and having a great time with his friends. And OK, so maybe he goes to the beach and he notices that there are some swastika flags and that somebody spelt out Heil Hitler with pine cones. And then towards the end of the book, it's like Jewish shops are having their windows smashed and his friends are disappearing and they're being tortured. And he's making this a record of what happens when the political absolutely inserts itself inside the personal lives, when we're sort of overcome by a political moment. And I knew that I didn't have the wherewithal inside that moment to say, this is going to be significant and this isn't. I don't have a clue, as I think most people are feeling right now. We don't know where it's going to go. But what felt important to me as an artist was to try and have a record of that state of confusion and that state of, you know, in the middle of my wedding, somebody looked on their phone and went, Steve Bannon's resigned. And I ran upstairs to write it down because it felt like, well, this is significant surely in some way, but I don't know what it's going to mean. We speculated a lot that day. I might speculate again now. But again, I still don't know the end game.
In not knowing the end game, it also lends to the overall feeling of the book of a person and a world that is in disarray.
Absolutely. A person who is feeling terrified, a person who is feeling paranoid. But I think also it's really a book about selfishness and trying not to be selfish. So it's somebody who finds it very hard to love and very hard to manage intimacy, trying to do that with one person, at the same time as acknowledging that they're in a world where they're intensely privileged and very selfish. And it's very easy to keep going with that, to decide that you're going to erect borders between people. We are very much in a moment that's about the erection of borders between different kinds of people. The wall between countries is the most sort of physical example of that, but it's happening everywhere. And this is really trying to say, like, this happens on multiple levels. It happens on a very private domestic level, and it happens globally. And I think the starting point for trying to challenge it is at least looking at what that sort of grotesque, funny, absurd, horrific selfishness actually is like.
Olivia Lang is the author of the new novel, Crudo. It is published by Norton. When it comes to that selfishness, Twitter has a great role in this, not only because of the president's tweets, but because of the character, the I/Kathy, and their obsession with Twitter. That really tells us a lot about selfishness in and of itself, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Selfishness, but also Twitter's this sort of horrifying and fascinating instrument in that it allows you to see what's going on in the minds of millions and millions of different people. And that's both a sort of incredible luxury and privilege and like a terrifying nightmare that we've all suddenly participated in. And the sort of Twitter scene, which I think most people are familiar with, of waking up in the morning and sort of turning it on blearily, maybe to see what your friends have been doing, and seeing some grotesque atrocity come up in front of your eyes, that creates a kind of numbness that I think is very dangerous. We become more and more numb to, inured to this sort of chaotic and violent reality. And I think that's something that art really needs to think about, and art really needs to think about different routes to manage that kind of information and make emotional sense of that kind of information.
When you say make emotional sense, is there a disconnect, though, because we have all of this information that it tends to take away that horror, as you mentioned, or the deep feeling that perhaps that we have, that we become numb mm-hmm. to what we're seeing because it is, quote, just a tweet?
Absolutely. I think this is an era that's creating a kind of numbness. And so there's a scene in Crudo in which Kathy's thinking about Philip Guston, the painter Philip Guston, who in the 1960s was was thinking very deeply about the Holocaust. And he was thinking in particular about the way that it all worked because of numbness, that a numbness began both with the victims, but he says also the tormentors. Everybody became sort of caught up in this situation that they couldn't see a way out of. And he thinks that numbing, unnumbing is the role of the artist, that there's something that you have to do to make people wake up to the situation they're in before you can even begin thinking about strategies to respond. Getting out of that numbness is crucial.
Tell us about the relationship between Kathy and her fiancé, because obviously this is Kathy's story.
I'm twisting my wedding ring as we speak.
Is a component, and yet he talks a lot but isn't central to the story, really.
Yeah, and I mean, the novel has all kinds of relationships with reality, but in terms of Kathy's fiancé, it is word for word what my husband said over the course of the summer, for which he's profoundly grateful, I'm sure. And it really was, you know, I'd written this book about loneliness. I was somebody who had sort of a very in-depth experience of loneliness, and at the same time hadn't quite realised the ways in which I was the author of my own loneliness and the ways in which I just hadn't learned those basic things about how to cohabit with another person, how to share a life, how to compromise. And so this is really a portrait of somebody learning those skills and struggling with their own self-absorption, their own narcissism, in a way that is both, you know, brutally true about me, but I think also has a kind of cultural truth as well.
Just on the first page, within the first paragraph of this book, you write, Kathy was met at the airport by the man she was living with, soon to become the man she was going to marry, soon presumably to become the man she had married, and so on till death. In the car, the man told her that he had eaten dinner with the man she, Kathy, was sleeping with, along with a woman they both knew. Well, right there, you're off to the races.
Yeah, people have complicated emotional and sexual lives. Let's acknowledge that.
So you think that this is going to be major, and then it's slowly that you understand as the reader that this is, for want of a better term, going to really be your data dump of information that is coming over that period of time leading up to the wedding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of into the idea of sort of starting off these threads that might have been the thread of a sort of grand realist novel and then just discarding them. That seems kind of funny to me. Like, the reader can fill that in if they want to. They can imagine those scenarios and what might have been going on there.
See, that's great. I love that. Because
I'm glad you do. Phew.
Because it is a jigsaw puzzle, isn't it? I mean, or it can be a jigsaw puzzle if you want it to be.
You can play it any way you like. I mean, you can get very obsessive about working out exactly the source of all of the information in it. You can find all of Trump's tweets in it and work out what day they were and be like, oh, that is the day. Or you can just read it as a love story. That's fine.
When you think about this as a novel, and I kept on wondering, once I knew a little bit about the backstory, that you could have done this as a journal as well, but you wanted it to be a novel, and as we talked about, you wanted to go through the voice and life of Kathy Acker. The sense of how different it is from your life, how different it is from reality, is that something that you cared about?
No, I didn't. What I cared about was that I couldn't do it as nonfiction. I couldn't do it as journalism. If I'd done it from a sort of authoritative, this is what I have to say about this moment, I would have lost that sense of chaos. I would have lost that sense. I needed to have a character's consciousness to do it through, because I needed to have somebody that was kind of borderline crazy. And that is not, as far as I know, the voice of my nonfiction. That's much more sane and measured, and that has much more a sense of this fact led to this. And we weren't in that kind of moment. And perhaps emotionally I wasn't in that kind of moment. So it really did have to exist as a novel. And I think it's a novel that uses true things in all kinds of different ways. But what novel doesn't, really? I mean, that's what Proust is doing with In Search of Lost Time. That's kind of the classic job of the novel anyway, to play with reality in different ways.
That entire idea, though, of being one tweet away from annihilation, and as you said a moment ago, you were worried about that. That was something that you were worried about in the summer of 2017. I would argue we probably still worried about that today. But when you think of it, how deeply was the concern of, I'm entering a new life with another human being, and I don't know what the world has in store, how much do you worry about that in the sense of, I want my relationship to be my relationship, however, I also want to be as happy as possible in whatever world is provided to us?
I think it's both. And I mean, there's what I want and then there's what the character in the book wants, and they overlap, but they're not always the same. Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I'd like there to be as much communal happiness as possible. I'd like us all to feel safe, and I'd like us all to feel loved. And, you know, that's an aspiration for a utopia. But this is a book that's very much haunted by death and coming to terms with the realization that to love is to accept loss. Which sounds really obvious, but actually in practice is incredibly hard. So the person Kathy marries, like the person I married, is much older than her. And she's very aware that by committing, by saying, I take you into my life, that she's opening herself to a kind of loss that she's never risked before. So that's one side of it. And then the other side is just very much being aware that we're coming towards some kind of end for human existence. We're filled with these stories, not just about the possibility of nuclear war, but about climate change, about these sort of drastic changes that our human lives are going to undergo. And I think you can be afraid of both of those things. And I think you can be afraid for yourself, but also afraid for people that you don't know, whose existence is going to get harder much quicker than your own is.
You just said a moment ago that much like the story in the novel, you also were marrying an older man. There are certainly things that are lifted from your own life, but also you are very true. There are biographical elements to the life of Kathy Acker as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I found it really interesting to do that, to go through and create this person who could plausibly have had the background of Kathy Acker, but obviously not died in the 90s, but continued into this sort of 21st century. So I've played with her timeline a bit, but it definitely has background elements of hers. And what was fun to me as well was the points of intersection, that there are kind of crossovers. There are people that we both know. So I could sort of insert them, and they are true both for her and for me.
In the writing, my understanding is that when Kathy writes something in the book, that is actually the work of Acker.
Absolutely. And that was fascinating for me to just say again how much Acker's work is relevant now. If we'd been chatting a couple of years ago, I might have said, I love Kathy Acker, but she's a 90s writer. She's an 80s writer. Her time's kind of passed. But suddenly, Acker's work is absolutely about now. It's about hyperviolence. It's about abortion. It's about complicated sexual politics. And it feels very timely. So drawing out these lines from her work and inserting them into Crudo was a way of just saying, like, look, this is really alert to this kind of political moment. And also very beautiful. Her writing is really, really stunning.
There are pages of dialogue. I mean, there are just pages of this inner voice coming out and long, long, long paragraphs. And it can be convoluted. It can be very dense. And yet, I assume that is what would happen if any of us, I mean, you said a little bit crazy a moment ago, but it's true that if any of us were describing our lives in this way, we would probably come off in a very similar vein, don't you think?
I think so. And I mean, my first book was about Virginia Woolf, and I think she is the writer who most underpins what I'm trying to do, which is really capture the actual textures of reality, not the realist novel, which doesn't particularly interest me, but what it really feels like to think and perceive and interact with other humans inside time. That seems a very interesting project to me. And I think any time you experiment with a stream of consciousness of what you're actually thinking, it's bananas, the things that we think and the connections that we make. So writing those things down, let alone the juxtapositions that happen with news, the whole thing is so incredibly rich and strange. It feels kind of absurd to me not to at least participate in that experiment, that modernist experiment of trying to record it.
You said a moment ago, as you were talking about this recording in real time, that because you weren't editing, you were not beholden to this idea of the perfect sentence that perhaps you would be in writing something that was not using this exercise.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, there are some beautiful sentences in this book. Are they very natural in the writing then? And do you as a writer then sort of realize of what comes more naturally versus what is ultimately honed?
It has been a real revelation to me. I mean, Crudo has had the lightest of edits, and that's really been much more about, like, maybe that line should be taken out because it's, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't, it's too personal, or it's politically libelous, or things like that. So it hasn't had
that
yeah, leaving that aside, it really hasn't had that kind of sandpapering that an editorial process might normally involve. So these are incredibly raw sentences. They are just as they came out. And it was very interesting to me how much more interesting it was to write like that. But the thing is, the kind of nonfiction that I write is very densely structured, so it sort of has to be sculpted and shaped. And I'm sort of hoping that there's some kind of fantasy form that I'm going to find next that allows me to have that sort of speed. It was like downhill skiing. It was like just slamming straight through a landscape, as opposed to sort of building a house out of matchsticks that's like 27 stories high, which is a complete nightmare to do.
Is this the way to write your first novel?
Well, if you want to do it really quickly, then yeah, I guess so. I think if this had been my first novel and I hadn't got a background of nonfiction, it would have been very hard to get published. I'm sure that's true. And I think it was quite amazing that both my publishers in the UK and here in America grasped the project and grasped the need for speed in publication as well, because publishers really don't like it if you hand something in the fall and say, I want this to come out in the summer, like this has to be done within a year. And they were amazingly good at just turning that round and being willing to participate in the experiment.
The novel is just so entertaining and so beautiful. It is called Crudo, a novel. It is published by Norton. Olivia Lang, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Congratulations and thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me. What fun.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.